Welcome, everybody, to the Weekend Interview Show. We're bringing back to the show today our first guest and one of our best so far, Alan Bock. He is no longer the senior columnist, but apparently has been moved up to senior editorial writer at the Orange County Register. He again writes for WorldNet Daily and, of course, the weekly Eye on the Empire column on antiwar.com. Welcome back to the show, Mr. Bock.
Well, thanks a lot for having me. I sure enjoyed it the last time, and see if we can get some talking done today.
Let's see here. You wrote this most recent column I read on antiwar.com is really the reason I called you. We've got this thing now in Iraq where I guess it's the basic quagmire where the longer we stay, the more the Iraqi people hate us, and the more they hate us, the less likely it is that we can pack up and leave, because then they'll just select an anti-American guy to replace us when we go. So we're stuck in this quagmire, and now the neoconservatives have apparently come out and said, oh, quagmire? Yeah, we planned on this. We're trying to trick all the terrorists in the region into coming into Iraq where we can kill them without reading them their rights.
Isn't that wonderfully inventive?
The fly.
I mean, you got to hand it to these guys. They sold the American people a war of aggression when there was no imminent threat or imminent danger to the United States, or even to the broadly considered United States interests abroad. You know, this guy was not going to attack anybody, but, you know, we went and took him out anyway. And one of the reasons, the things that they sold us was, you know, there's a big link between Iraq and terrorism. Well, now that we're done, there sure is, isn't there? So they sell it as, yes, this is wonderful. We're concentrating all the terrorists in you know, putting them on flypaper where we can kill them, and this is a great step forward in the international war on terror. Oh, these guys are something else.
Yeah, they really are. And, you know, I was wondering when I was reading that article, is there really much evidence to indicate at all that foreigners are actually coming into Iraq to do this fighting, or is this just the Iraqi people?
As far as I can tell, and I haven't been there, but I've read a lot from people from different perspectives. I'm pretty sure there probably are some. I talked to a guy that was retired CIA a couple of weeks ago, and he said, "Yeah, you know, the Saudis actually have been cracking down on some of their domestic terrorists, and so partially as a result of that, some of them are heading over toward Iraq, usually through Syria, and." Setting up to, you know, do some damage to the Americans because, hey, that's where the Americans are. If you're a bank robber, you go where the money is, and if you're a terrorist, you go where the Americans are.
Yeah, they're just sitting ducks over there now. I mean, I guess this should sound like a pretty good idea unless it's one of your kids over there who's the bait.
Well, you know, it's got to be tough because... What's really, you know, frustrating about these neocon, you know, war whoopers, who just think that the most wonderful thing in the world is to, you know, is to have a war from time to time, and maybe even a war that goes on for a long time to sort of, you know, buck up the courage of the American people and test our mettle and, you know, make sure that we really do have the most up-to-date and effective weapons and
what is this, Germany?
Well, you know, it almost sounds that way, doesn't it?
Yeah,
you know,
I mean,
it's certainly not the America. It's not even the America I grew up in. You know, I grew up during the Cold War, and there was this sort of steady, you know, drumbeat of, you know, you got to watch out for the Russians because they're going to come get you. But, you know, now we're in a position where there's nobody that's going to come get us, and everybody knows that. But, you know, we still need to go out and find a reason to do a little war now and then anyway. It's just nuts. And almost none of the people who are doing this are people who have ever actually served in the military. I think you can notice a pattern without a lot of trouble here that, you know, whenever there's talk about, well, what's going to be the next thing? Is it going to be Syria or Iran or North Korea? You know, it's always the military guys that say, hey, wait a minute here now. We're not sure if we want to do this. And it's these guys that have been, you know, career civilian defense department types who've never served in uniform who say, oh, yeah, we can do that one. Yeah, piece of cake. Cakewalk. problem at all.
Yeah, they'll welcome us with flowers like the people of France did when we liberated France from the Germans.
Oh, yeah, you noticed that they have, you know, of course, I'm sure that it's a mixed bag over in Iraq. I'm sure a lot of Iraqi people are extremely happy that Saddam Hussein is gone. But I think they really expected the Americans to do a better job of, you know, sort of the basic stuff like having water and electricity going than we've turned out to do. And so I think that's part of the reason that we've had a lot more resistance there. And I'm sure that there are, you know, bot party loyalists in little groups, you know, huddling in some house without electricity and planning what they're going to do next. And there's probably some Al-Qaeda types. But, you know, Iraq has become, you know, the place where terrorists go if they want to get a piece of the Americans. And, you know, we're there. Unless we wise up and say, okay, Iraq for the Iraq. It's time that we gave up these little imperial ambitions and got realistic about what we can do and what we ought to be doing in the world at large. You know, the United States is going to be there for a long time, and the taxpayer is going to be paying billions of dollars a year for years and years to come, you know, to keep these Iraqis under control. Part of it is because we have this real, you know, condescending sense toward people who are not Americans who are not, you know, sort of West European origin, because that's our origin. So naturally we think, you know, most Americans' origin. So naturally that's what we think is advanced and sophisticated and really civilized. And most Americans don't have a sense that there are other ways to organize civilizations and other civilizations that, you know, are older and more established than ours. And maybe they have reason to think their ways are really the civilized ways and our ways are the barbarous ways.
I think it was something you wrote, but I'm not sure. It was something I read about probably a month ago or something that referred to a short window of opportunity where the Americans really could have won over the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people in the first couple of weeks there, but that once we blew it, we blew it, and it's way too late now.
Yeah, I think that sounds like the retired CIA guy that I talked to a few weeks ago. That's very much what he was saying. You know, if we'd really gone in there with, you know, a lot of engineers and probably a lot more forces to guard the engineers and really sort of whipped that infrastructure into shape, you know, most of the Iraqi people would have said, "Hey, this is cool. Stay as long as you want. Just don't shoot us too much. We'll be happy." But even now, even a guy like Richard Pearl, of course, Richard Pearl again is very shrewd. He distances himself a little bit from, you know, the day-to-day decisions. But there was just an article this week in Richard Pearl saying, you know, I think that, you know, the United States underestimated the complexity and the difficulty of doing the occupation of Iraq. And so even a guy like Richard Pearl, who was sort of the chief warmonger, the dark prince out there, is saying, you know, we should really leave Iraq as quickly as possible.
That's funny. When he says the United States underestimated, he means he underestimated on behalf of the rest of us.
Of course, he was sort of the gray or black eminence behind all the war plans. You know, he met with they talk about this cabal that they have in the Defense Department of people, neoconservatives, who are enthusiastic about war as a means of spreading democracy or whatever it is that they claim they're doing this week. And, you know, they meet regularly, and Richard Pearl is sort of the senior strategic planner, so to speak.
Yeah, well, he's the guy about a year ago who said, "Oh, all we need to do is put in maybe 10 or 15,000 men from the inside out, and it'll be no problem. Trust me."
Yeah, well, I hope that what the American people are learning from this is when a guy like Richard Pearl says, "Trust me," you know, that's time to run a credit check on him. Call TRW. Call up Google and see how reliable he's been in the past. and how seriously he's underestimated the complexity of these wars that they think are, you know, the key to order in the world.
And speaking of the complexity of this, something that really caught my attention in your last column on antiwar.com, you wrote, if the attacks from Sunni elements continue, the Shiites will have an incentive not to let the Sunnis be perceived as the only Iraqi forces pestering the Americans and eventually perhaps being largely responsible for driving the Americans out. So the majority group, the Shia, the majority in Iraq who have mostly been attempting to cooperate, at least, you're saying here that if the Sunnis keep up their fight, then the Shia are going to have to join in too, or else they'll look like the suck-ups to the foreigners.
Yeah, it's a delicate balance. I think, and maybe some people in the occupation forces are coming to appreciate how delicate the situation is. But you know, the Shia have been the majority, and you know, there've been a few little flare-ups here and there, but they've sort of been cooperative with the American occupation forces for the most part since the Saddam regime was effectively thrown out, because they know they're the majority in the country, and they figure eventually we're going to get something remote that's pretty close to a democratic way of choosing the central government, and when that time comes, that's our time because we got the numbers. So they've been sort of biding their time, but the longer it takes for some kind of a semi-democratic process to happen, as I said, the more incentive that they have to start doing either what would you call them, terrorist, guerrilla, anyway, violent activities, usually accompanied by weapons, against the Americans. Because the longer it takes to get a democratic process in place, the longer, you know, the longer it is before they get a chance to take power, and they want to take power. They think that's their birthright.
Do you have any suspicions about who was responsible for the bombing in Najaf the other day, where one of the leaders of the Shia was killed?
At this point, I really don't. I'd sort of rather not speculate on it because, you know, who knows who it could be? Maybe it's some Sunni. Maybe it's a Shia faction. The guy that was killed, the imam, at least the TV said that he was supposed to be a moderate. That's what the news reports say. I don't know how well you can trust that, but he probably was not a guy that was whipping up groups of people with weapons to go out and kill people. And so maybe, you know, it was a radical Shia element that was, wanting to take out the moderates so that they would have a clearer path to take power themselves when some kind of democratic thing takes place. But I don't know. You know, you could speculate till the cows come home, and probably in a couple weeks we'll have a reasonably accurate idea.
Well, what do you make of the bombing of the United Nations headquarters there? I mean, even if, you know, here we are, Richard Pearl talking about, wow, maybe we ought to get out of here as fast as we can and turn it over to the United Nations. Well, apparently the UN isn't any more welcome than we are.
Well, you know, I think, again, Americans, most Americans, it's fairly rational in some ways not to pay too much attention to foreign affairs because, you know, for the most part, our leaders keep these active battles thousands of miles away. So why pay too much attention unless your son or daughter is there being shot at? All the things that are going on, the way that the UN is perceived, you know, a lot of Americans perceive the UN as being this sort of, independent force full of anti-Americans, and to some extent from an American perspective it is. They certainly engage in a lot of anti-American rhetoric and they resisted the war, but they didn't do anything to stop the war. But in the Middle East, for the most part, the UN is perceived as, whether it's true or not, generally perceived as sort of the stooge of the United States. And, you know, they may talk and babble a little bit from time to time and raise some objections, but sooner or later, eventually, the UN goes along with what the United States, the biggest imperial power, at least as perceived in the Middle East, wants to do. So, you know, why should we see the UN as our friend in the Iraqi situation. They're just doing the U.S. bidding. So that's the way a lot of Middle Eastern people see it, and I'm quite sure that a lot of people in the U.N., a lot of people who are supporters of the U.N. were really shocked by this, because, again, everyone wants to have the most positive self-perception. If you're the U.N., you perceive yourself as being, you know, the reasonable, rational forces of peace and mediation and bringing people together rather than condoning conflicts. And to some extent, that's what the people in the U.N. are trying to do. But, you know, if you're not perceived that way by the people you're trying to bring together, sometimes they'll punch you.
Well, if the U.N. thing isn't going to work, I guess let me ask you this way. If you were the president right now, and you inherited this mess, what would be a reasonable exit strategy for getting us out of there without leaving a bigger mess than we caused when we came in?
I don't know. I don't know if it's possible to do that, to pull out without leaving a bigger mess than was there, except possibly it is. And here's the reason. Saddam really was a rotten guy. And even though for the last X number of years, 10, 11 years, he hadn't really been a big threat to the neighborhood. You know, he was a guy with sort of an inflated sense of himself, and he had used, you know, chemical and biological weapons in the past. So he was a guy that, you know, for the Iraqi people, it probably unbalances better that he's out of there. I think it takes a while, a bit of confusion and problems in order for the for things to settle down so that it's a reasonably peaceful thing. But I think it's sort of condescending on the part.
Hello, are you still there? Uh-oh, Alan Bach's phone cut out, everybody. We're going to have to call him back. All right, everybody, we are back. Poor old Mr. Bach had a dead cell phone, but I think we got it all worked out now.
I believe we do.
All right. Okay, so what we were talking about, I believe, when your phone went dead, sir, was about a decent exit strategy to get us out of Iraq.
Well, you know, if I were president, which is about as likely as a frog having hair, you know, I would just say, okay, we've kicked out the bad guy, and we now believe, as we've always said we have, that we, as the United States, that's only the friend of freedom, believe that the best people to decide about what the future of Iraq are the Iraqi people. And we have no interest in it being anything other than what the Iraqi people want, because now we know there's no threat to the United States from those, you know, from the nasty intentions of Saddam Hussein. So go ahead and establish whatever kind of regime you want. We're gone in 3 months because it will probably take that long to gather all, you know, our equipment and arrange for places to send our men, you know, when they get back home, and you know, bunk beds in the bases stateside where we're going to bring them back home. So, you know, it'll take us a little while, but we're out of there. And we believe in democracy. We always have believed in democracy. We've always said that we don't want to be a colonial power. You know, we're the friend of freedom, United States. So Iraq, do it your way. And you know, we'll you know, if you need a couple of diplomats here and there to help mediate a dispute, you know, we'll be happy to provide something like that. But we're gone, and have a happy democracy. That's what I'd do. You think George W. could do that?
Oh, I think he could easily. Do I think,
you know,
he will?
If
absolutely
he really
not.
Decided, he could turn on a dime and do it like, you know, lickety split.
Sure, but you know, it's been pretty clear to me, I guess, in my view. I don't really have any hard evidence to back this up, I guess, but it seems to me that the reason that they didn't go in there with a decent plan for reconstruction or setting up a limited republic over there is because they wanted a disaster. they wanted to blow that window of opportunity as fast as they could so that they can keep us there for 10 years. They want to have a permanent base in the Middle East, and if it can't be the Saudi Peninsula, then they just moved it a little bit north. But we're not going anywhere.
Well, I have to confess, that's what, I don't know, do you ever read Stratfor.com?
No, I haven't, but I'll start reading it now.
It's a bunch of ex-professors and former intelligence people that have a, and I think they're actually in Austin, if I'm not mistaken. They're someplace in Texas. Who have a website that, you know, talks about, you know, foreign policy strategy and intelligence and stuff. And they've said from the beginning that that was really the United States. And you know, they're friendly to the Bush, you know, but sort of independent of the Bush administration at the same time.
They but like it, but they're just a little more honest.
Yeah, and they've always said, you know, the purpose of the American incursion is to establish a base for future forays against terrorists and possibly against other states in the Middle East. And it'll be convenient to have it in Iraq because, you know, from Iraq you can, you know, reach into Syria and reach into Iran, and if there's trouble up there you can reach into Turkey you know, just have a forward base for the war on terrorism. And I suspect that's really what the Bushies want too.
Yeah, it seemed like foolishness at first, but then I remember these people aren't fools. I mean, the chief executive notwithstanding, the rest of the people surrounding him, they're not fools. This isn't an accident.
Well, I'm so, you know, what can you do? I think we have to keep talking about the fact that the administration lied us into war, or at least grossly exaggerated us into war. I think the most amusing thing that happened in the week since I wrote that column is now we're starting to have these stories about how the administration thinks that shrewd old Saddam sent over some phony double agents to spread all these tales of weapons of mass destruction to fool the United States into, and then they sort of fall silent, because to fool the United States into what?
Are you kidding me? I hadn't even heard that. Where did you find
that? Oh, there was a story in the LA Times. There was something on Fox News about it, you know, that you've got, you know, anonymous administration sources saying, you know, we're starting to think maybe, you know, the guys that Shalabi was showing us and, you know, from the Iraqi National Congress and some of these other agents from Iraq that were telling us about all these weapons, we think they were kind of plants. They were trying to, you know, exaggerate the extent of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq in order to
convince
get the United
the Americans
States
to overthrow
him. Yeah. Yeah. Is that what...
That
you
sounds
know,
like
Saddam,
the rational decision-making process of any communist dictator, right? Provoke the most powerful nation on earth into coming and overthrowing you.
Yeah. So that's, you know, that's really great fun to start listening to those excuses. And you know, I think you know what we as critics of a policy of empire have to do is just keep pointing out the absurdity of all these rationales that the administration keeps coming up with and continuing to ask the question, do the American people really want to run an empire? Do we really want to be the new Rome, you know, or the new Great Britain that rules the earth as far as the eye can see so that the sun never sets upon our areas of influence and power?
No, of course we don't, and we never have, and that's why they always got to trick us into all these stupid wars and lie to us into believing in this, because the American people, this country was founded on rebellion from a criminal empire, and ever since, you know, we took Hawaii, the American people have been tricked and lied to and misled and forced to accept foreign wars that they really wanted no part of at all.
Now, you know, if you get out, you know, go to, you know, biker bars and, you know, various other kinds of places, you can, of course, run into people who say, well, yeah, we really ought to go over there and kick some butt on these guys. But, you know, this is not a serious imperial desire. It's sort of a desire to kick some butt, at least vicariously.
Well, sure, and they all say, well, let's go over there and kick some butt and come home. It's always, and come home is at the end of the sentence every time.
Yes, it is, every time, except when, the neocon empire lovers are talking. You know, and then it's, establish democracy and spread our influence and make sure that there are no future threats, that our grandchildren can live in safety. They have their own kinds of rationales, but I think, what the American people need to do is look at this situation, look at not complete wreckage, but, it's still at least as chaotic in Afghanistan as it was before, although maybe a really bad regime is now out of power, which is a good thing. And just say, we're not going to believe you next time, suckers.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that they would try to leak out the story that, oh, wow, Saddam must have fooled us, deliberately fooled us into believing he had weapons of mass destruction, the fact that that even got out of the boardroom discussion and into trial balloon mode in the media is, to me, just, I don't even know what to think about that. Somewhere in the administration, these people sat in a room and said, I know what will leak. We'll tell them that Saddam tricked us into believing he had weapons of mass destruction because he wanted to be overthrown. Yeah, go out and tell that to some reporter from the LA Times. There was nobody in the room who said, wait, don't do that, man. Nobody's going to buy that.
When people read this, they're going to laugh at us.
My God, man. I mean, how stupid do they think we are?
Well, apparently they don't have a real high estimate of the intelligence of the American people as a whole, or they have a low estimate of attention span, and who knows, that may be justifiable to think that by and large the American people don't have much of an attention span, because so far there is not an effective anti-war movement that looks to me like it could rise up and stop the next adventure that these guys want to get us into. And I'm not sure where it is. I think there are different neocon factions that are rooting for different adventures. Some people want Iran, some people want North Korea, some people think Syria would be a nice next one. And I guess in a way we have a window of opportunity here, and I think it's a wider window of opportunity than the American regime had, to put together an effective anti-war coalition, not just to the kind of people that are willing to march in the streets, but the kind of people that are willing to call up their congressman and say, hey, look, we're running the biggest deficits in American history. We've got a lot of our troops at risk overseas right now. The military tells us that the military is overstretched and is going to have a lot of trouble trying to successfully complete all the missions that they're assigned right now, let alone take on something new. Let's pull back a little bit. Let's take a little time to reassess what kind of role we want the United States to play in the world at large, and have a more modest set of ambitions, and have a long talk about whether we want to be an empire or not before we do anything else.
You're asking the unreasonable there. If you want the discussion to be in terms of reality and not in terms of some whitewash excuse, I mean, if you want to really have a discussion about empire, you're going to have to get people to accept the fact that there's even an empire to discuss.
Well, I think in some ways, I almost admire some of the neoconservatives for being as open in their use of that word as they have been. Max Boot, the guy, the former Wall Street Journal editorial writer who was who did the book on Splendid Little Wars.
Senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations.
Yeah, that's what he is now. He's more than happy to use the term empire. And various other people are. And so let's say, okay, everybody admits that what we have in effect is an empire. It may not look exactly the same or be governed exactly the same as the Roman Empire or the Austro-Hungarian Empire or the British Empire or the, you know, all these other, the Russian Empire, all these other various empires that have gone, appeared and disappeared throughout history. But we've got an empire. So, okay, we've got one. Let's sit down and talk about what kind of empire we want to be. Do we want to be an empire of benevolence, or do we want to be an empire of coercion, an empire that says that it's in favor of using force in order to make the lesser breeds without the law bow down to our diktat? Or do we want to just say, you know, we're here, we'd like to trade with you, we don't want to run you, we're the good guy empire.
Yeah, so, the only kind of empire I want to be is a former empire that renounced its ways before it fell, like the rest of all empires in history.
Well, that would be the best of all. And I'm still convinced that these progressions are not absolutely set in stone, even though it looks to be, you know, if you look at history, there seems to be a pattern. You know, a country becomes prosperous, then it becomes strong. Then it, you know, decides it has to have wider influence, then it becomes an empire, and eventually it gets overstretched, and the empire, you know, crumbles. That seems to be the usual pattern, and it may well be, the pattern that, the American empire takes. And there may be no getting around it. But I'm still convinced that if we have this discussion, you know, as a society, and it's a lot more complex discussion, but in some ways that's easier than if you just think of it in terms of the political process. You know, you don't have to have a lot of candidates in the primaries now who are saying, let's stop do the empire. As long as that discussion is going along on talk radio, on the internet, various other places, eventually it will filter its way up to the political process. And you know, then the function of a political leader, the usual function will kick in, and the usual function, of course, is to figure out where the people are and run around, scramble to get ahead of them and say that you're their leader. So, you know, we need to work on any number of levels, and I think it's mostly the levels of persuasion to say, you know, we're Americans, we don't want an empire, let's give up this empire thing. It hasn't gone that well so far, and we think the world will be a better place if we gave it up. And let that sentiment become so widely established that it trickles up eventually to the political class, so the political class eventually gets the message and tells the neocons to go back to their think tanks.
Yeah, or just cease to exist. I don't even feel safe with them at their think tanks, to tell you the truth.
Well, I have to agree with you there, but, you know, if I'm not in favor of lining them up and, you know, in front of a firing squad, but yeah, they need to say, okay, you know.
Well, maybe after a fair trial.
But at some point they have to decide, and if maybe we're fortunate that a lot of them are getting up there in years, that, you know, their time has come and gone, and it's time for a new thing. It's time for here's a cliche, a new birth of liberty in these United States.
Oh, that sounds good to me. And, you know, the whole firing squad thing brings up the issue of war crimes. Now, George Bush has basically finagled a deal whereby anyone in the military or in the federal government of the United States is exempt from the International Criminal Court. The rest of us are not, by the way. So he didn't really unsign the ICC. What he did is he worked out a temporary, I guess, 6-month or 1-year reprieve for the American elite. But it is undoubtedly clear that during the last Gulf War, or the beginning of this current Gulf War 12 years ago, and during the wars in Bosnia and in Kosovo, over the last 10 years, quite a few American policymakers and generals and very powerful people have been guilty of violating all sorts of international law, as far as, you know, Geneva Conventions, bombing waterworks, bombing electric using cluster bombs, and there are people all around the world right now who are talking about, wouldn't it be great to put George Bush or Tommy Franks or some of these criminals in front of international war crimes tribunals? And I just wonder, you know, since we, the American people, have let our leaders get away with all of these war crimes, what do we do about foreigners who want to put our leaders in check for us? I mean, should that be, is that something we should allow to happen for Americans to go in front of an international court for the crimes that I think you and I would probably agree that they have committed?
I don't know. I'm not too enthusiastic about that idea.
I'm not saying I'm enthusiastic about it either, but I know that a lot of people...
But I know there's some foreigners that are, and for example, Belgium, I guess they've changed their law just in the last few weeks, but they... At one point, Belgium had a law such that they could, you know, sort of indict and subpoena any person that, you know, their domestic courts decided was a war criminal anywhere in the world, which is, it's turned out to be mostly for show because they didn't have the power to enforce a subpoena in Indonesia or some South Africa or wherever. No, I'm sort of content to let history judge the bastards. The problem with most international tribunals, and it even started at Nuremberg, is they tend to be courts of the victors and the guys that have the power now. And so there's always a certain amount of, you know, victor's justice and triumphalism whenever they have one of these show trials. You know, I just didn't let the guys rot in their own juices and you know, go out of office and spend the rest of their lives, you know, trying to justify themselves, how they got sucked into committing war crimes.
And then, you know, assuming that we can ever hire some prosecutors who understand and care about the rule of law, maybe they could be prosecuted here in this country for violating the Constitution and any laundry list of other laws that they've broken.
Well, maybe they could be. Maybe they could be. But to some extent, already the court of public opinion is starting to render its judgment. There were a couple of things this week in the news that I found interesting. I think it was Rasmussen that did a poll and asked Americans, is the United States safer now that we've had the war in Iraq? And I think it was like 47-44% said no, the United States is not safer. So I think the American people are starting to understand that, you know, this war, whatever the details about the weapons of mass destruction turn out to be, maybe they are in the Bekaa Valley now, who knows. But the war was a mistake, and the war has made us less safe rather than more safe. You know, I think that's a good building block to lay a new monument to liberty in this country.
I absolutely agree with that. I think that right now more than ever, the people who usually go along and believe their leaders and trust the government and cheer for the winning team are really listening now. And they really are saying,
I think a lot of them are. I really do. And I think as time goes on, and of course, you know, it becomes then the responsibility of anti-war people to make their case, you know, in a civil and responsible way, so that you persuade people rather than beat them over the head. You know, to just keep asking those questions. Say, you know, this war didn't really make it safer, did it? Do you think the next one is going to make it safer? And even more fundamental questions like, do you think you get a world of peace and civility with means that include killing, destruction, and demonizing your foes? Is that the road? You know, we live in a world of cause and effect. If you use violent means, you're going to achieve violent ends. You know, that's the way the world works. People talk about whether the ends justify the means. The means determine the ends. If you use violence to get your way in the world, you're going to have a violent world when you're done.
And if you have a philosophy of liberty and respect for individual human life, then the ends never justify the means. It's never okay to kill 6,000 innocent civilians, even if it is to get rid of a Saddam Hussein.
Absolutely right. And you know, the more that discussion goes forward, you know, the closer we are to being safe. And so the more people like us are able to convince our friends and neighbors and you know, people we go to school or church with, you know, that, you know, more war is not the answer to the problems that we face in the New World Order, the better off we're going to be. So, you know, we have our work cut out for us. Fortunately, it's pleasant work because, you know, what it consists of is talking common sense and persuading people and being civil to them. That's not bad. You can spend your life doing that.
Yeah, that doesn't sound so hard to me. For example, since we only got about 10 minutes left here, or maybe a little bit less, I want to squeeze in a little bit about North Korea here. A column before last on antiwar.com was called, I believe, Korean Prospects for Peace. And he wrote about how, this was 2 weeks ago, I guess the meetings are ongoing right now, the six-way talks.
Yeah, I think they may have just ended yesterday.
Oh, they just ended yesterday. Six-way talks between Russia, China, South Korea, North Korea, Japan, and the United States. And you wrote about how John Bolton, the U.S. Undersecretary of State for Arms Control, came out, what, a week or two before the meeting started and just blasted Kim Jong-il. And I wonder, what do you make of that? What are they trying to accomplish there?
Well, I suspect what's going on is that, again, there are probably factions within the administration and maybe some differences between, you know, State Department people, Defense Department people, and, you know, all these sort of informal advisory boards that they have going on as well. You know, there are certain factions in the administration and, you know, sort of in the Washington establishment, you know, who think, you know, now is the time that, you know, to do a regime change in North Korea. So we need to figure out a way to make a real shock and awe military strike that will take out Kim Jong-il's ability to retaliate. Problem is, you know, that's going to be a real hard thing to do because, you know, they've got artillery by thousands along the so-called demilitarized zone that can reach Seoul, heavily populated areas of South Korea. Tens of thousands of people could be dead within days. And anybody that's even a slightly honest military planner knows that that's the risk you take when you start thinking about doing a first strike on North Korea. You know, we're gonna be eventually responsible for tens of thousands or maybe even hundreds of thousands of our so-called allies in South Korea being slaughtered. You know, if you're thinking about precipitating that, that's got to be a heavy burden on the conscience even of the most cold-blooded human being you can think of.
Well, I think there's a certain percentage that don't have a conscience at all.
Well, I think we need to recognize, as all of North Korea's neighbors recognize, that this is, you know, one of the last two or three failed communist states. It's a basket case economically. Like a lot of communist states, it does still have some military potential, some military power, but they understand, but they can't come right out and say it, that the communist system has failed them and they're ready to sort of rejoin the world. But the only way they know how to communicate with the world is with bluster and threats. And, they perceive the United States as having been steadily hostile to them ever since, the non-truce at Panmunjom in 1953. So the first thing they need to do is work out something with the United States. They want the United States to say, you know, to sign a non-aggression treaty so that they know that the United States will not invade them, will not do a first strike on them. And the only way they can figure out, and it's a bad way because it's likely to make, you know, the hawks in the administration that much more hawkish, you know, is to talk about, well, we're going to have us a weapon pretty soon and we're going to be able to, you know, and I think our course there needs to be, again, let the neighbors handle the problem. Let South Korea, China, Russia, Japan, they've all got a lot stronger interest in how the North Korean regime behaves itself than we do, because if the regime can't be either persuaded or nudged into behaving itself and not being a threat to its neighbors, they're the ones that are going to get it. You know, so let them handle the problem. You know, if I were the president, again, I would say, you know, we need to let the neighbors handle this problem, and just as a strategic nudge to push you neighbors into taking responsibility for this thing that we, the brave and noble United States, have had, you know, on our plate for so long, we're going to pull our troops out of South Korea by a date certain, and you know, if you guys haven't figured out how to handle North Korea by the time those troops are gone, then you'll have to pay the consequences. We need to jumpstart this process of the neighbors taking responsibility for the you know, for the bad neighbor in their midst.
And it must be said too that North Korea, but, you know, as a nation, wouldn't even exist right now if we hadn't had that war in the 50s. They'd have gone out of business when the Soviet Union went out of business.
Probably so, yeah. So, but, you know, you need to spin it as a shrewd strategic move. You know, that's what I do, you know. This is, you know, this is the United States, and we're taking care of our business first. You know, we've been, you know, this generous philanthropic power providing defense and help all around the world. And, you know, we think you guys are grown up enough to handle it on your own now. So you know, we've done our job, and it's time for us to move on. The nice thing about that is that most of the troops we now have in Okinawa and Japan are really there for the support of the troops in South Korea, so they could go too. And that would eliminate another huge source of conflict and resentment in Japan against the United States. So, again, we can say, you know, we're trying to reduce, you know, all the sources of disagreement in the world so that we can really have peace. And we can be, you know, the peaceful empire of benevolence.
Yeah, there you go. You'd make a really good press secretary for a libertarian president, Mr. Bach.
Maybe so.
All right, everybody. Alan Bach, he is no longer the senior columnist, but now is the senior editorial writer at the Orange County Register. He again writes a weekly column for WorldNet Daily, and of course, every Tuesday, Eye on the Empire on antiwar.com. Thanks for coming back on the show, Mr. Bach.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's been fun, and I hope I haven't bored people with my babbling too much.
Well, you sure as hell didn't bore me. I know that. This has been a great fun.
Well, thanks so much. My pleasure. And let's do it again soon.
All right, cool. Have a good one.
You too.